This week on Brilliant, we look at a terrible thing that went through a murderous rampage in the American Southwest in the late 19th century. A thing so dreaded, so awful, the locals refer to it as the Red Ghost. I'm Alan Brill. Welcome to Brilliant, a podcast from the mind of Brill. Warning, it gets dark in here. Thanks for joining me again this week. And if it's your first show, welcome. If you're listening to this on YouTube, be sure to hit a like and subscribe on this bad boy. And also, I am available on Spotify, Amazon Music, or most of your other podcast platforms. So check it out wherever you would prefer. Now, this week, to start it off, when I dug into the files of the strange and unusual, I found two of our favorite pranksters here in Relicabra Studios. The first one comes from the Sussex Evening News, 18 October 1994. A man returning to his Mini parked in Shaftesbury Palace, Brighton, was surprised to find someone had broken into it and attached an anti-theft lock on the steering wheel. He had to call firemen to release the vehicle. I mean, that's definitely a dick move, but hats off. That's pretty clever. I wonder, just a random guy threw the club on his steering wheel and left and never saw the payoff. I respect the heck out of that, but I wonder if maybe if someone he knew and stood and lurked by to see the aftermath. Anyway, that's a bizarre crime, and I'm here for it. Imagine walking back, you'd be like, is this my vehicle? Oh, it's not my vehicle. And you find out it is, and there's a club on there. It's anyway, good work, sir. Good work. Now, the Daily Star, on November 17th, 1994, reported the following. Police were hunting a prankster dressed in a Halloween costume who had been terrifying old folks. Clad in a black hooded robe and brandishing a scythe, he looks exactly like the classic image of death incarnate. He was seen creeping up to the windows of nursing homes and hospitals, terrifying elderly victims who believed the Reaper had arrived to end their lives. One pensioner said angrily, "I was terrified. I just couldn't move. I was so scared." In a six-month period, he struck more than 50 times in Los Angeles, California. A policeman said, "It might sound funny, but what this clown is doing is an invasion of privacy, and that's against the law." That's messed up, dude. Terrifying the elderly isn't cool. But you made my files, so there's that. And also, I guess there are worse and more destructive hobbies to have out there. So that's going to conclude my list of our favorite pranksters today, proving you can be a jerk and still be really, really funny. Now we move on to the murderous desert rampage of the Red Ghost. The legend of the Red Ghost began in the American Southwest in 1883 when the tents of two Mexican gold prospectors was destroyed near the San Francisco River. Now, fortunately, the two men survived to tell the tale. They claimed to have awoken to the sound of thunderous hooves and an ungodly shriek. They climbed out from underneath their collapsed tent just in time to see something, quote, taller than two horses, end quote. It galloped off into the brush, and they gathered their wits and began to follow the terrible beast. They found strange tracks in the creek before losing the tracks in the rocky cliffs above. Just a few short days later, the Red Ghost would kill. A woman was gathering water from a stream near Eagle Creek, Arizona, when a reddish beast tore through a fence and attacked her, trampling her to death. Hearing her screams, the woman's sister ran from the cabin to witness the attack. She claimed the animal was being ridden by a skeleton. That's right, you heard me. Now, she was just too terrified to help out her sister, so she did what she could do. She gathered the children, and they barricaded themselves inside the cabin until the menfolk returned from tending the herd. After she told her grisly tale, the men armed themselves and went out to investigate. They found the woman, quote, trampled and crushed as though a troop of cavalry had run over her, end quote. The coroner asked the woman to describe the beast, and she said it was reddish, very tall, and ridden by the devil. This elusive yet destructive creature was sighted a few more times, always disappearing back into the desert. Cy Hamlin saw the creature. He came over a ridge and saw a huge animal roving through the chaparral about half a mile away and identified the beast as a camel. He said the animal had a gruesome burden strapped to its back. Months later, the camel was spotted by a rancher who noticed something weird about it. Strapped to its back appeared to be a human skeleton. The dangerous animal was accused of all manner of nefarious acts, and the locals became terrified for their very lives. The camel and its skeleton rider became known as the Red Ghost. Now, this leaves me with two big questions, and fortunately the first one I can answer. Just what the hell is a camel doing in Arizona in 1883, just roaming the wilds? Well, turns out we can thank the U.S. Army. They introduced camels in the Southwest in 1855 when it tried to form the Army Camel Corps. They wanted to develop a supply route from Texas to California, and honestly, camels seemed to be an ideal fit for such an undertaking. They could eat all types of prickly plants that horses can't. They travel faster, climb rugged terrain better than horses, and travel farther without water. On paper, this is a slam dunk. The problem is, as it turns out, sometimes people suck. There weren't many trainers with experience working with camels, and camels can be ill-tempered and difficult to work with. This combination led to many of the animals being abused. The cavalry thought of them as abominations, and mule drivers considered them a threat to their livelihoods. Also, they produced an odor that spooked horses and mules. Then came the American Civil War. Troops were withdrawn from the Southwest and redeployed in the East, and the Army Camel Corps was disbanded. Many of the animals are simply set free in the desert to fend for themselves, and for years people report seeing camels wandering the Gila and Colorado rivers. Wild camels would continue to be spotted until 1907, and the last wild camel died in a California zoo in 1934. Now, camels are semi-docile pack animals, but when mistreated can become violent killers. They are terrifying. Turns out camels are bad mamma jammas. Adult males can weigh up to a ton and run 40 miles an hour. They can fit an adult human's head, leg, arm, torso in their mouth and easily pulverize them. And also they spit. There are reports as recently as 2023 of fatal camel attacks when a camel in India bit off a dude's head. You heard me. It bit a dude's head off. In 2021, a camel killed two people in Tennessee after escaping from the Shirley Farms Petting Zoo. And another fatal camel encounter happened in 2014 at a monkey sanctuary in Tulum, Mexico. There is little doubt that the Red Ghost was mistreated and a killer made. So, we can reasonably see how a murderous camel could be roaming the Arizona desert. But what about its terrible rider? On that, I can only speculate. That it did have a skeleton rider is pretty well confirmed. A party of prospectors on the Verde River saw the camel feeding, and two of the men crept up into firing range and took their shots at it. Now, they missed, and the Red Ghost scrambled away, but as it was running away, they saw a bundle fall off the camel's back. It turned out to be a human skull. Now, one of my favorite encounters occurred a few weeks later. A cowboy rode up to an abandoned corral, and the Red Ghost charged at him from the corral. The cowboy managed to lasso it, but it rammed his horse and all three went down. The Red Ghost chose not to stay and fight and took off into the desert, trailing 60 feet of rope behind it. He said later that the pack on its back was nearly gone, but he had no doubt that it was once a man. So, who was this poor guy? One theory floating around was that it was a soldier dying of thirst who bound himself to the beast in hopes that it would carry him to water. Now, this sounds reasonable, but it's said that the bindings were tied in such a manner that he couldn't have tied himself or untied himself from the straps, so it seems as if he's put there by somebody else. But why was the poor bastard condemned to an agonizing death and an ingenious form of revenge? Some think perhaps a corpse was tied there simply to get rid of incriminating evidence, but I mean, there's got to be an easier way to get rid of a body, right? We will never know the identity of this unfortunate soul or how he came to meet this unusual fate, but he does ride on through history. And as for the Red Ghost, well, sightings began to dwindle. One reason probably is that as the corpse decayed further and dropped pieces of itself all over the desert, it became less distinguishable than, say, a herd of camel. And also, I'm sure it made the Red Ghost calm down not having a dead dude strapped to his back. But ultimately, it met its fate one morning in 1893. A rancher named Mizzou Hastings awoke to find the beast grazing in his garden. He killed the creature with one shot from his Winchester. Now, the corpse was long gone by this time, but the camel still bore traces of its former rider. Hastings said, quote, "The animal's back was heavily scarred from the rawhide straps that had been used to tie down the body of a man. Some of the leather strands had cut into the camel's flesh." End quote. I mean, how long had this poor animal wandered the desert with a dead man lashed to its back, the smell of death constantly filling its nostrils, and no way to escape it? One would think that this terrible burden would drive it mad and turn it into a killer of men. I think that's fairly understandable. Now, Mizzou Hastings tanned the unfortunate beast's hide and made a pair of boots out of the Red Ghost. And that, my friends, is the story of the Red Ghost and the U.S. Army Camel Corps. Slip on your traveling shoes, because for this next story, we're going to Scotland, to the wooded region that surrounds the shores of Loch Ness, where we behold the majesty of the Loch Ness Camel. Now, a camel in the American Southwest, I can't explain, but a camel in Scotland? Well, let's check it out. In the book The Highest Strangeness, Richard Foreman writes the following. In June 1990, Lieutenant Mick P. Fordyce related to Scott's Magazine a sighting he and his fiancée had 58 years earlier in 1932, the year before the spate of modern Loch Ness monster sightings started. Fordyce writes, "In April 1932, while living in Kent, my fiancée and I traveled to Aberdeen to attend a family wedding. At the conclusion of the function, rather than return south straight away, I decided to show her a little of my native land. We cut across to Inverness, where preparations appeared to be in full swing for a Highland gathering. After dinner in the late evening, we took a stroll through the town and saw men in shop doorways and at street corners practicing on their bagpipes. The air was full of sublime music, and the air was rent with strange, wild sounds. The following morning, we set off on our journey back to England. The weather was fine, a beautiful spring day, and we had a lovely run by the side of Loch Ness as far as Foyers, where we spent time admiring the famous waterfall. Shortly after leaving Foyers, the road to Fort Williams turns away from Lochside and runs through well-wooded country with the ground falling slightly towards the loch. Traveling about 25 miles an hour in this wooded section, we were startled to see an enormous animal coming out of the woods on our left and making its way over the road about 150 yards ahead of us towards the loch. It had the gait of an elephant, but looked like a cross between a very large horse and a camel, with a hump on its back and a small head on a long neck. I stopped the car and followed the creature on foot for a short distance. From the rear, it looked gray and shaggy. Its long neck gave it the appearance of an elephant with its trunk raised. Unfortunately, I had left my camera in the car. But in any case, I quickly thought discretion the better part of valor and returned to the vehicle. This strange animal occupied our thoughts and conversation for many, many miles, and we came to the conclusion that it was an escaped freak from a menagerie or a zoo. We felt that a beast of such tremendous proportions would soon be tracked down and captured. Apart from scanning the national papers for some time in search of mention of the creature, we let the matter rest. I told other members of my family what we had seen, and they urged me to publish the story. But I have not done so until now. At the time of the sighting, we were quite unaware of there being anything strange in Loch Ness. But in autumn of that year, stories started appearing in the press of an unusual animal being seen in and around the loch. It was the spring of 1933, and the term Loch Ness Monster came into general use. Now, at that time, there weren't any zoos in the area, the closest one being in Edinburgh Zoo and the now-defunct Glasgow Zoo. The former being 156 miles south of Loch Ness, and the latter being 168 miles south, and neither one reported missing camels. Also, just to be clear, there were no circuses in the area. And this wasn't the only sighting of the Loch Ness Camel. In September of 1919, William McGruer and his siblings saw a beast in the Inchinnakardock Bay, where they described as brownish yellow with long legs and a long neck that looked like a camel. When it saw the children, it walked into the loch and vanished. Now, what Lieutenant Fordyce described doesn't sound like a normal camel, but like a different kind of beast altogether. He said it was large, shaggy, and gray. And to me, his description sounded almost elephantine. He also used the descriptor freak when describing it. So could this be a different beast altogether? If it was, there is a somewhat popular theory on how this unearthly beast and even Nessie herself came to inhabit the loch. And it involves a great beast, Aleister Crowley. You see, in 1899, Crowley purchased the Bullskine House on the shores of Loch Ness. And while he was there, he intended to carry out a magic ritual dating back to the 1400s, translated by a Jewish scholar from a North African manuscript. It is the ritual of Abramelin, a ritual that took 18 months to perform. It involved the summoning of a guardian angel and the summoning and binding of the four great dukes of hell, Lucifer, Satan, Belial, and Leviathan. And I guess I should point out that Leviathan is the ancient sea dragon. Now, it's said that he believed he failed, but what if he actually did manage to summon these beasts? Could that account for the monsters lurking in and around Loch Ness? Now, truthfully, I think Crowley was a self-promoting clown and nothing more. And I also think that Lieutenant Fordyce probably just saw a camel, as did the children. I think the strangeness of seeing a camel in the Highlands of Scotland may have altered his perception of what he saw. Let me be very clear here. I would never presume to tell him or anyone else what they saw. And if it was a camel, then that to me is still deliciously weird. How on earth would a camel come to be roaming the woods of Loch Ness? I would love to know the story behind that, and it sends my imagination spinning into gear just speculating on it. And that to me is enough to make it just a great story. While we're in Scotland, we might as well boogie on over to the Overtown Bridge in Dumbarton, Scotland. Now, the Overtown Bridge has earned a nickname, the Dog Suicide Bridge. Since at least the 1950s, our canine companions have been hurling themselves off the bridge and into the 50-foot ravine below, often with fatal results. There are reports that put the number in the hundreds and other reports that say fewer, but there's no disputing the fact that a lot of dogs have perished at this bridge. One report even claims that a dog survived the plunge, ran back up on the bridge, only to hurl itself off again. So this begs the question, just what in the heck is going on over there exactly? And that brings us to the White Lady of Overtown. Her ghost is said to have been seen wandering the bridge at night. Some legends have it that she was the widow of the lord of House Overtown, whose early death broke her heart and left her in a debilitating state of depression. And after her death, her sorrow has bound her spirit to this bridge. 20 years later, she started driving people's beloved pets to suicide because reasons, I guess? And why wait 20 years, you might ask? Well, I think time is a little different in other realms than it. In fact, I don't really think time is linear at all, but we'll tackle that one on a later date. But I don't generally get tripped up on the delay, but the why of it eludes me. I'm not sure why she would want your canine companions to jump off, or why her overwhelming sorrow would only affect dogs, or maybe it affects more than dogs, because to add more dark history to the Overtown Bridge, in 1994, a 32-year-old man threw his two-week-old son off the bridge because he thought the child was the devil. In January 31st, 1995 issue of the Scottish newspaper The Herald reported that Moy was sure the devil put a birthmark in the boy's head and that he and the infant were to blame for the Gulf War. They also feared he would destroy the world by infecting mankind with a virus. Later, he told police he had to save the world by killing his son. This bridge has a dark history indeed. Could whatever force that compelled Moy to commit infanticide be the same force that drives dogs to suicide? Nah, he was quite mad before he went on the bridge with his son. This was an ongoing issue with him. And if you are having a mental health issue, I would urge you to dial 988 and seek some help. Now, the supernatural angle didn't sit well with animal behaviorist David Sands, who was determined to figure out the real reason for this bizarre behavior in our pets. So in 2010, he rolled up his sleeves and dug into the data. Now, what he found out was that most of the dogs that jumped were long-nosed breeds, and so he figured scent must be heavily involved. So he explored the ravine, and he found rabbits and squirrels, but these scents wouldn't have the reaction that people were reporting. And that's when he found the minks. These notoriously musky critters would certainly fit the bill. So he set up an experiment where most dogs ran directly to the scent of minks. But would a dog really throw self-preservation to the wind to give chase to these stinky varmints? Probably not. But in addition to the wild mink smell, the construction of the bridge could also be a contributing factor. See, the bridge has tapered edges, which from a dog's point of view might appear to be a safe, flat plane. Sands says in his documentary, "I think it's highly likely that in all cases here at Overtown Bridge, that it was curiosity that killed the dog." Now, if minks are the cause of the strange behavior, then why aren't other Scottish bridges having the same effect on man's best friend? Another proposed cause is a frequency that humans can't hear, infrasound, basically. Is it a vengeful supernatural force? Is it clinical doggy depression? The maddening scent of wild monks, infrasound? Whatever the cause, Overtown is one sinister bridge. And if you visit with your canine companion, hold tight to their leash and beware. Now, for this story, I took the bulk of it from How Stuff Works Online and Mysteries at the Museum. And for the Loch Ness Camel, I got most of that from The Highest Strangeness by Richard Foreman. And for the Red Ghost, there's numerous causes or places that I looked to find it, but the bulk of it came from Backroads Lore, Volume 3, The Weird Wild West by Chad Lewis, David Weatherly, and Kevin Nelson. I truly hope you enjoyed this week's guided exploration of the strange with me, and if you did, be sure to hit that like button and maybe subscribe so you don't miss any further shows. But thank you so much for joining me, and I'll see you next week. But until then, I warn you to be careful, because it can get dark out there.